Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for January's Emergency Club webinar. I am delighted to welcome to Webinar Club our speaker for today, RCVS Recognised Specialist in Emergency and Critical Care, Stefano Cortellini. Thank you, Stefano. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you for the introduction and welcome everybody. So I'm Stefan, I'm one of the lecturers in emergency and critical care at the Royal Vet College. And being an emergency and critical care vet, I usually deal with trauma patients, and they actually represent a big amount of our caseload. And several studies, like we know that roughly 10% of the emergencies are represented by trauma in dogs and cats. And in particular, I think it's quite important to focus on the traumatic brain injury, which is often associated with trauma. And it's one of those conditions where we can't really do much, but the things that we can do, we need to get them right. And so it's through this presentation, I think what I would like to deliver is a little bit of understanding what actually is traumatic brain injury and what happens, even if we go slightly into more the pathophysiological, if you want more academic side, but that is essential to understand why we need to do certain things. And also what we'll discuss about is therapy, what we need to do, what we can do, what are the things available, and how to go in order. With trauma, we usually have loads of worries. We've got several main problems. And I think what we want to do, especially with traumatic brain injury, is try to put them in order so that we don't miss anything. And then we prioritize in a good way. And so we'll see also what is this tier approach. So a sort of step-by-step approach that we can use to manage our patients and to actually optimize our patients' management. So if we look, for example, at traumatic brain injury, what is this defined as? A head trauma associated with either decreased absent consciousness, altered mental status, or presence of neurological deficits, but can also lead to more severe neurological impairments such as seizures or coma. And really, the exterior aspect of the patient doesn't really tell us much about the amount of brain injury. Certainly can tell us about the presence of a head trauma. Like in this case, for example, this patient ran into a tree, and you can see that there's definitely head trauma, like we have a hole in the cranium. But the patient is relatively bright, so certainly there's a there must have been a traumatic brain injury, but this is mild. And this can be a little bit more, if you want, mild compared to other cases where potentially we don't have significant external changes, but the mental status of the patient is severely affected. Can I have the video number two, Ima, please? So that basically you have, for example, patients like this that certainly have evidence of head trauma, like you can see the apoptosis of the eye, but they are completely unconscious. Obviously, and comatose, actually not responding even to painful stimuli. And so it's quite important to detect patients with head trauma and that can have suffered traumatic brain injury, but the two things are not necessarily directly related. And that's because head trauma can definitely, any sort of trauma, which can be blunt, penetrating, or a mixed type of trauma, can cause a primary injury. This primary injury can be mild, can be moderate, but can lead then to secondary injury to the brain that can be enhanced by other factors that are not just related to the initial trauma. And so, for example, when we speak about primary injury, that's obviously the factor that triggers the whole traumatic brain injury cascade. And this can be, as we said, externally not evident, like in concussion, where you haven't got really external signs, but basically you have loss of consciousness, even transitory, but like not external signs. But then you can have internal damages. Internal damages can that can be like sheer injury, like axonal injury, or you can have contusion, so a hemorrhage associated with the trauma at the site of trauma. So, for example, if you have a depressed fracture of the skull, there can be a hemorrhage in that focal area. Or we can have a hemorrhage that occurs in another part of the brain that is not directly involved with the trauma. So it's the famous coupe-contre-coupe lesion. Or you can actually have direct damage by the inciting cause with penetrating injury. And for example, like we see in this cat that was bitten by another cat, and actually what you can see here is a clipped area of his head, but this was a whole abscessation. And so the primary injury is certainly an important factor, but it's not the only one that determines how our patient is going to progress, because actually the important part is also related to secondary injury. What is this? Well, we've got a head trauma, we've got a primary injury, and this can cause, for example, cerebral edema, potentially, which will lead to increased intracranial pressure, the cranium, and I'll tell you now, but I will repeat it several times over the course of this hour. The brain is obviously enclosed into the cranium, so that is not really extensible. So if we have an increase in the volume of the brain, dictated, for example, by cerebral edema, well, that can increase the intracranial pressure. What's that gonna do? Reduce the blood flow, hence the oxygen delivery to the brain, because there's no space for the blood to actually get in the brain, and this will lead to energy imbalance. What does energy imbalance do? Well, the cells of the brain parenchyma actually regulate their function and regulate their size by the use of ion transporter, sodium or calcium. And obviously, when we have a trauma, there can be release of excitatory transmitters, or you can have an energy imbalance. So these transporters don't work as they should. And so basically, what this leads to is further cerebral edema. And so you have kind of all this vicious cycle that keeps on repeating and exacerbating if we don't address necessarily all the different things that can affect it. And so each of these factors can actually lead then to brain injury. And so when we speak about traumatic brain injury, we're not just talking about the primary injury, but it's also the secondary injury that can be related to the primary, but that can also be related to other factors external to the central nervous system and to the trauma itself that we can regulate. And that's in particular important because of the size of our patients, traumatic brain injuries is usually associated to polytrauma. So our patients rarely just suffer from traumatic brain injury. Yeah, that's definitely that, or head trauma alone. This can definitely happen if they get kicked or bitten, or have excluded or fallen from the height. But most of the times, these traumatic episodes actually determine several damages systemically, including the traumatic brain injury. And so all the abnormalities that can occur in trauma can then lead to enhancement of this secondary traumatic brain injury. And we're talking about everything. So hypoxemia, if you've got a patient with lung contusions or pneumothorax, obviously it's going to be hypoxemic, and that can affect further the reduction in oxygen delivery to the brain. Same thing, hypoperfusion. If a patient is hypovolemic and is bleeding, well, that's going to determine a reduction in the oxygen delivery through a reduction of cerebral perfusion to the brain, and hence enhance the secondary brain injury. But we can also have little other things that we often don't look at because we don't consider them priorities, but that can actually affect the overall increase or worsening of the traumatic brain injury, such as hypo or hyperglycemia, temperature regulation, or CO2 regulation. Obviously, as polytrauma, we also have the head trauma itself, and obviously that's then determined by the brain edema that can be even just like secondary to the primary injury, and this can lead to increased intracranial pressure, which is something that we will then focus on. And certainly, these two aspects are something that we can try and correct and address directly looking at central nervous system. But the point is, we have to look at the holistic view of our patients, not just focus on the brain. And hence, and so basically focus on all these different aspects. And so when we think at the brain, obviously the best thing that you can do to support a brain that has been injured, but in general every single organ that has been injured, is allow appropriate perfusion. Because this allows basically oxygen to basically be delivered to the brain. And it's quite interesting how the cerebral blood flow that gets to obviously the brain is regulated by the difference, by the ratio between the cerebral perfusion pressure and the cerebral vascular resistance. Now, the cerebral perfusion pressure is regulated by the difference between the mean arterial pressure and the intracranial pressure. So in health, the intracranial pressure is normal, mean arterial pressure is normal, and the gradient between the two allows actually the blood to actually have a good perfusion, the brain to have a good perfusion. On the other side, we have cerebral vascular resistance that basically is an ability of the brain to autoregulate the resistance of the vessels, so basically to allow that the blood flow is maintained throughout different states of hypoperfusion or hypoxemia. And this autoregulation responds, as I said, to variations in the systemic blood pressure, so mean arterial pressure, or even, like for example, of other chemicals like PaCO2 or PaO2. Now, and so this actually, this autoregulation and this formula, if you want, summarizes a little bit how the brain is able to compensate to changes into the systemic condition of the patient and actually assure that one of the major body organs of our body is continues to receive blood flow, hence oxygen. The problem is when you have traumatic brain injury. So if this is a situation where in health you've got mean arterial pressure on the x-axis and on the y-axis the cerebral blood flow, well, when you have even low blood pressure, like around 50, 60, a normal mean arterial pressure should be around 65, 70 millimeters of mercury. So even when it's low, well, the autoregulation of the systemic of the cerebral vascular resistance allows the cerebral blood flow to be constant. This doesn't happen though when we have traumatic brain injury. And so the cerebral blood flow, because there's no autoregulation, the cerebral blood flow is actually directly proportional to the systemic mean arterial pressure. So this is the reason why we actually have to concentrate on maintaining a normal blood pressure in traumatic brain injury. Because if we don't correct that, the brain will actually suffer from hypoperfusion. Simple as that. It just cannot compensate for changes in the blood pressure. Same thing happens with PaO2, for example, which you can see here in the blue dotted line, or the PaCO2. So, for example, if the PaO2 decreases, cerebral blood flow will increase. Because that's just a normal reflex that basically will determine a little bit the ability of the brain to get more oxygen. With the PaCO2, basically the lower is the PaCO2, the more vasoconstriction there will be, and the higher the PaCO2 will be, the more dilation there will be in the brain. Just to allow basically scavenging of all this CO2 from the tissues. And This autoregulation, which can be partly be present in basically traumatic brain injury, is something that we really need to be worried about. So, for example, in a patient that has cerebral edema and has hypoventilation, so is unable to excrete the CO2 adequately and has an increase in PaCO2, like here, what's happened is that the cerebral blood flow is increased. That sounds good initially. That's great because that means that we are perfusing the patient. However, there is a concern because basically this increase in blood flow can actually then determine an excessive increase in the volume within the brain and lead to intracranial pressure, increase intracranial pressure. And so we really need to make sure that this PaCO2 and PaO2 are strictly regulated, and so that we make sure that if a patient is hypoventilating severely, we may have to ventilate them, or we may have to intubate them if they've got any obstruction, or if they are hypoxemic, that we deliver oxygen and we target the underlying cause if we can, potentially. And so this is essential for cerebral perfusion. This is a big area, I think, of the initial pathophysiology of the traumatic brain injury. However, another one important is the increased intracranial pressure. And I would like to thank Dr. Joe Fan, who's a great neurologist that we have here at the RBC, for providing this nice kinematic artistic view. But basically, as I said before, we've got the skull that encloses the brain. If we have cerebral edema, an increase in the volume due to, for example, a fracture fragment that depresses the brain, or if we have a hematoma that forms subdural hematoma, extradural hematoma, anyway, that starts pushing on the brain, well, there's a limited amount of space that the cranium can accommodate. And so what is it going to happen? Well, the cranium can accommodate to an increase in the intracranial volume, like you see here on the x-axis, until you reach a critical volume. After this critical volume, there is no more space in the brain. So what's going to happen is that to an increase in volume, even small, you can have a huge increase in intracranial pressure. And so, for example, this is just a condition, a normal, let's say, representation of the brain, not necessarily in the right proportions, but basically, if we have in the brain CSF, then the blood compartment represented by arterial volume and venous volume, and then the cerebral parenchyma. Well, if we, let's say, get hit and we have this sort of mass effect, so if we have a hematoma forming within the brain, well, what's going to happen? The volume is going to increase and it's going to start squeezing other compartments until basically the other compartments cannot be squeezed anymore, and you can see already how the cerebral parenchyma can be affected here. Also, the vascular compartment is affected as well. And so, what happens there is that as the hematoma increases in size or the bleeding continues, well, you have a huge spike in the pressure. And what does that lead to? Increase in intracranial pressure and potentially to herniation that can be transtentorial or through the foramen magnum, or can actually be even through, like, for example, an aperture caused by a fracture, for example. And before, though, herniation is usually irreversible. Cerebral herniation, you cannot do anything for that, unfortunately, once it happens. And so what we want to do is actually capture the patients that are at risk of intracranial pressure and act on those. And so how do we do that? Again, allowing good perfusion of the patient, and also trying to detect when this intracranial pressure is about to cause herniation. And that usually the last step that we have is the Cushing's reflex. So what happens? If you've got an increased intracranial pressure, the blood flow to the brain will be reduced. So as a consequence, the CO2 will accumulate within the central nervous system. This accumulation of CO2 will determine a sympathetic release. So basically, like a sort of alarm to the body to try and get this CO2 out of the brain. And so what happens is there's Vasoconstriction, huge vasoconstriction systemically, because we've seen that the perfusion pressure depends, in the previous slide, we've seen that it depends from the difference between the mean arterial pressure and the intracranial pressure. So if the intracranial pressure increases, well, the body as a last ditch, last try, will increase massively its arterial mean arterial pressure. This huge hypertension, though, will trigger a reflex bradycardia. And the patient at the moment with increased intracranial pressure will obviously have a comatose, stuporous mental status. And so this is a triad that is called Cushing's reflex. It's very, very so characterized by hypertension, reflex bradycardia, and altered mental status. And so this tells us that basically the patient is about to herniate, and we should use this as a sign, even if very late, but it's usually, we have to use this as a sign to act immediately. Unfortunately, at the moment, we haven't got many other tools for measuring intracranial pressure. For example, in people, they will do direct measurement of the pressure in the cranium through transducers. This is not something that we can do in clinical practice. There is some new evidence regarding looking at, for example, optical nerve sheath diameter as so with the ultrasound, and this will be increased when there is an increased intracranial pressure. However, we haven't really got, if you want a normal reference range, there's a wide variety within dogs and dog breeds. And also, there's no study that actually looked effectively into this aspect on clinical patients. So I think, unfortunately, we still need to rely on the clinical exam alone. And so, after going through this run through the pathophysiology, what we can do is obviously we always have to start with patient evaluation. So a patient presents to us for traumatic brain injury, like this German Shepherd dog. But obviously, what we don't want to do is just focus on the brain. And there can be lots of problems, but what we want to do is actually an ordered approach so that we're not missing anything and we're not focusing on the higher or the most evident abnormality. That's a normal thing to do in emergency. I find myself when I'm stressed, I'm obviously gonna focus on what goes straight into my eyes, like what is the most what is the thing that I think is the most dangerous, but you may miss more subtle things that may actually be more determinant in affecting the outcome of the patients. And so we always have to have a little bit of a basic approach, and that's based on the sort of triage rules of ABC. So check for airways. Is the airway clear? Yes, no. If it's not clear and the patient is actually suffering from hypoventilation or cannot breathe, we may have to take control of the airways. This is very rare, but in some cases it can be life-saving if we know that we have to intervene. And it can happen a lot of times, like in traumatic in head traumas in cats, for example, we can have severe cranial fractures that can affect, for example, the nose and the airways. And so, in some cases, we may have to intervene, but normally, again, it's not as common. Also, looking at the breathing, so the airways may be fine, but they may have abnormalities in the breathing. And so, we actually, even if there's severe head trauma, we still need to focus on auscultating the patient, understanding if the patient is hypoxemic, or understanding if the patient is ventilating fine. I know it seems very basic and probably redundant, but I think it's a very big aspect to consider and reconsider as we go along with our patients. And then circulation. Is the patient bleeding? Has the patient got an internal bleeding? Is the patient hypovolemic or in shock? And basically, this leads to the tier approach. So when we treat patients with traumatic brain injury, well, the first thing is obviously assessment. And the first assessment would be, is the patient seizuring or not? If the patient is seizuring, we start with anti-seizure medications. But if the patient is not seizuring, we go with triaging the patient, exactly like we said, focus on the major body organs. Are the airways okay? Is he breathing okay? And is the circulation okay? And the first treatment for traumatic brain injury is stabilization. So there's not much around treating focusedly traumatic brain injury within the CNS, the central nervous system. The important thing is stabilizing this patient with fluids, with oxygen therapy, potentially with ventilation if you need, but again, very rarely. And if the patient stabilizes, then we can monitor them over 72 hours. But if we are worried, then we may have to implement and use a smaller therapy, hypertonic saline or mannitol. And then if that doesn't work and we're worried about the patient, well, then we may have to think about doing further imaging and doing a decompression surgery or potentially intubating the patient and hyperventilating transitorily. Again, this is more in people, but inducing hypothermia. But again, I'll speak about this because they're a little bit more complicated and they're very rarely required in our patients. Also, because especially for the hyperventilation and hypothermia, there's not much evidence around it. The common denominator of this tier approach, so it's like you've got different levels, but there's a assessment based on neurological assessment, and so something called modified Glasgow Coma Scale. I'll speak about this later, but it's really important that we stabilize the patients and then we reassess the patient neurologically. We can't do the whole full neurological exam. I mean, that has to be done initially, but I think to drive and has to be done at some point, even in two different occasions, so on arrival and later on. But I think what we want to focus on is actually the modified Glasgow Coma Scale, of which I'll talk a little bit later. So, patient on arrival. Is it seizuring? We treat it. We may treat it with diazepam, midazolam. They are very short acting and they allow us to control the patient seizuring. And we may start, for example, phenobarbital just as initial treatment to control eventual further seizures. And then we start again doing a triage and stabilization. How do we do that? Well, airway and breathing, obviously doing a clinical exam, we can use DSPO2. That's actually quite useful in clinical practice, but not necessarily always achievable, especially in cats, for example, or in dogs if they're moving, if they've got pigmented membranes, or if they're in shock, the SpO2 may not be necessarily reliable. However, if you can, that would be great if you can measure it, because then you know that if you get a reading above 95% and you know you can trust it, well then the patient is doesn't have a huge respiratory compromise. If you want to be a little bit more precise, say you're in doubt, you can always take an arterial blood gas. This is not something that we necessarily do. I think it's very useful to actually just go with a clinical exam. And if you're worried that there is pneumothorax or anything, just start, for example, administering oxygen and see if they respond to oxygen. You can start with oxygen flow by, like in this case, or in oxygen tents. The problem of the oxygen tents is that you can't actually monitor the patient continuously, but you just have to leave it there. As soon as you open the tent, you're gonna disperse the oxygen. What I would avoid is nasal cannula or prongs, initially at least, just because they can trigger sneezing, and sneezing can cause an increase in intracranial pressure. So I think it's just something that we don't want to really do in the beginning. And then you can use your, for example, you can use your diagnostics and the FAST scan, so the focus assessment with sonography for trauma comes very useful because it allows you to see if the patient has pulmonary contusions or potentially pleural effusion, so hemorrhage, or in some cases even if you've got a diaphragmatic hernia or rupture, sorry. Or if there is pneumothorax. It does require a little bit of training, but it's something that is very feasible and easy and can give a huge amount of information. Obviously, in patients that have severe respiratory distress and have a clinical exam that is compatible with pneumothorax, for example, muffled lung sounds, you can, if you don't want to take a radiograph, and in the acute setting, radiographs may not necessarily be the first step that I would do. You want to stabilize the patients first and then eventually do some radiographs. And so that's why the ultrasound comes in place. But in cases where your clinical exam is quite suggestive of, again, pneumothorax, you could just try with a blind thoracentesis. The whole point, though, is basically stabilizing the respiratory function by oxygen administration and then potentially some initial investigations that can tell you if he actually needs oxygen administration or not, and if there's something that you can actually act on or focus on. The other important aspect is circulation. Again, I know this is very basic, but it's always good in these cases because they can be very stressing, just at least to have a mental scheme. And so, obviously, clinical examination is hugely useful to assess if a patient is in shock or not. And we usually use perfusion parameters, so the mucous membranes, they need to be nice and pink. If they're pale, you know that there's a vasoconstriction going on there because of possibly shock. Heart rate. The heart rate is usually in shock is highly increased. But for example, if you get, we've seen the Cushing's reflex, right? Like, so you've got increased intracranial pressure, systemic hypertension, and reflex bradycardia. So you can have some patients that in shock, but with traumatic brain injury, may have a borderline low heart rate. And so it's also important to think about the heart rate, how it relates to the overall clinical assessment that you're making. Obviously, evaluating as well pulse pre the pulse quality, or for example, the respiratory rate as well can be a sign of perfusion, or the temperature of the extremities. Mentation itself can obviously give you a, is used usually as a clinical perfusion parameter. Patients in shock will be obtunded, they won't be bright. However, in this in traumatic brain injury, so in this setting, it's probably a little bit less useful, the mentation to be used for shock assessment. Anyway, the whole point is you've got some clinical parameters in traumatic brain injury. Some of these can be a little bit misleading, so see heart rate or mental status. But in general, the clinical exam can give you an idea if the patient is in shock or not. And on top of that, what you can use and should use is a blood pressure, because you also have to know, is the patient hypotensive? Yes, well, we know that there's a linear relationship now between the cerebral blood flow and blood pressure. So you want to, and there's no autoregulation in traumatic brain injury of the cerebral vasculature. So you want to make sure that you are spot on the right blood pressure. And you can also use, for example, other markers of perfusion, so lactate, more or less useful in the trauma setting. I find it very useful. But, you know, like an increase in lactate is a metabolite of glucose. It accumulates when there is hypoperfusion of the tissues. So lactate is normally between 0 and 2.5. If we have a patient that presents with a lactate of 5, so double the maximum reference interval, well, that patient is probably suffering from shock. And so I know that patient is in shock, and I will start looking at causes for that. Just a little note, that lactate can be sometimes a little bit misleading, because there can be other causes for increase in lactate beyond even just shock. But in the trauma context, it's definitely a useful thing to do. Measure a lactate and remeasure afterwards. And then obviously an ECG. How do we treat a patient in shock? So if a patient is shock, hypotensive or, yes, hypotensive and possibly has a hemorrhage, well, in general, what we tend to do is start with isotonic crystalloids. Veterinary medicine is still a little bit behind compared to human medicine, where in trauma now, there is this need of only blood product administration. This is not no nearly achievable in veterinary medicine, and I think it's still very reasonable to start resuscitation in a patient with shock with crystalloids. Now, this would be one of the situation where basically we would use potentially sodium chloride as well, which is like just normal saline, physiologic saline, just because it's more isotonic than the Hartmann solution. And in people, in human guidelines for trauma resuscitation, there is a thought of potentially having to use isotonic crystalloids compared to slight hypotonic one and Hartmann solution, as the latter can potentially cause an aggravation of the cerebral edema because of its hypotonicity. However, we don't know, and I think it's still very unknown in veterinary medicine. No one looked at this, but I think if you have a patient with hypovolemia, well, you can definitely consider starting with crystalloids given in bolus, so 50 mils per kilo in 15 minutes, and reassess the perfusion parameters, clinical and with a blood pressure, and then see if that's improved, and eventually continue. If we want to use less fluid, we could potentially use hypertonic saline. There's different concentration. We've got the 7.5%, and usually we give 3-5 mils per kilo. Very important is that you should be giving that relatively slowly. Don't give it quickly. I know it's a small volume, but don't give it quickly because it can trigger bradycardia and vasodilation. So if given quickly. So 3-5 mils per kilo, very safe if given over 10 minutes. And the whole point behind hypertonic saline is that it's a hypertonic fluid. So basically, you're giving a small amount of fluid and it's drawing within the vasculature water. So you're basically doing a sort of autoresuscitation. So you're giving some fluid to just basically recruit fluids from outside the vascular compartment to increase the blood volume. And so you're not administering excessive amount of fluid. Obviously, the hypertonic saline, exactly like the isotonic crystalloids, as crystalloids in general, are a little bit short-lasting, so much of the fluid that you're giving will actually dissipate in the interstitial volume by an hour. So it's very good for the acute setting, but much of this fluid may actually be lost in the interstitial space within like an hour. And so for this reason, some people look at synthetic colloids as resuscitation. Now, this is a huge chapter, and I'm happy to answer to some questions, but at the moment we don't tend to use synthetic colloids because their efficacy is currently unproven in terms of outcome in trauma, but we know that they could potentially be dangerous because they could determine acute kidney injury or potentially even coagulation abnormalities. Again, I think we're kind of following the human medicine studies, but there are definitely some studies in dogs and cats that have shown that potentially there is a risk for an increase in acute kidney injury using this synthetic colloid. So at the moment, we tend not to do that, to use them. The other option, so this was resuscitation, so we need to resuscitate the patient so to achieve a normal perfusion. But on top of this, there are little things that basically we can do. So elevate the head, and elevating the head by 30 degrees, well, it's always very much one of the things that you say, oh yeah, sure, like elevate the head, like if it does something, but actually it does. So I would like to thank Dr. Crawford, one of the neurologists here, for providing this little table. But basically, you can see that if a patient has a flat, is flat at 0 degrees, there'll be, these are all obviously healthy patients with have a intracranial pressure of 15, and then basically it will reduce if you just elevate the head by 10 degrees. Same thing with neck to applying pressure on the neck. So if you see here, at rest, the intracranial pressure is kind of normal, but as soon as we compress the jugular veins, the intracranial pressure increases hugely. And same thing, avoiding increase in intra-abdominal pressure. So if even just expressing the bladder will increase the intracranial pressure hugely. I think this is quite important because anything that can be, for example, sneezing, straining, for example, constipated patients, or patients that are straining, or patients that are whining, for example, because they're painful, will increase the intracranial pressure. So in a patient where we've got traumatic brain injury and we're concerned about a rise in intracranial pressure, I think considering sedation, analgesia, and urinary catheter may actually help. And so these are the things that we want to do initially. So little things, avoiding jugular compressions, elevating the head, avoiding any sort of stress, whining, or pain, and resuscitating the patient and making sure that the patient is actually normoxemic. And then we go on to neurological evaluation. That's done with the modified Glasgow Coma Scale. So a full neurological exam will be done. However, I think in an emergency setting, I often find myself as well. I'm not a neurologist, so I will always focus on the important things. And so the modified Glasgow Coma Scale is quite an interesting assessment method that can be used and could potentially be related to prognosis as well, and needs to be done on admission. And then, if you are worried, basically you have to repeat that every 60 minutes because it's quite useful in terms of assessing if your patient is worsening or if your patient is actually improving. So, to actually guide your therapy. And it's based on three categories that you assess. It's very easy. It doesn't take actually long to do, so it's actually quite useful. And you can focus on motor activity, brainstem reflexes, and consciousness with a grade that goes from 3 to 18. The higher it is, the better the prognosis is, and the less is the neurological compromise. The lower it is, the poorer the prognosis. And these are some results in dogs. And so, what do we do? First thing is motor activity. If the patient is walking, like the one that we saw before, with, for example, the head trauma, the whippet, with a big hole in the head, but actually walking around, well, that was a six. But then you may have, like this people, like this guy's here, unfortunately, that you may have lower scores. And so you go through the recumbency, whether there is extensor intermittent rigidity, or whether this extensor rigidity is persistent and is associated with potentially opisthotonus, or if the patient is totally flat and has got decreased tone and absent reflexes. So motor activity is one. Here we can see, can I have the video number three, for example? Thank you very much. And so here, for example, we also see very typical, let's say, posture with flexed hind limbs and opisthotonus and extension of the forelimbs. This is very typical of cerebellar involvement. And in traumatic brain injury, we need to be worried because this is actually potentially a sign of early increased intracranial pressure and cerebellar herniation. So if we have a patient like this, we actually want to act quite quickly in reducing the intracranial pressure. And then you can actually get to this cerebral herniation, so decerebrate posture with extensor of all four limbs and opisthotonus, and this is kind of a very poor prognostic factor. Then what we do is assess the brainstem reflexes, and we do that very easily with PLRs, papillary light reflex, and the pupil size, and the oculocephalic reflexes. And basically, having normal reflexes, that's great, that respond to light, that is a very good sign. But then, as what we're worried is that basically we have damage to the most caudal parts of the brain, and so in particular the brain stem. And let's say that if we have lesions of or a lesion at the level of the most cranial part, so with the where the basically sympathetic tone is or regulator is, well, what we're gonna have is a bilateral meiosis up to the pinpoint pupils, which is regulated by the parasympathetic. However, as the damage goes and potentially herniation goes, well, you've got also involvement of the parasympathetic nuclei. And so what happens is that we're going to start having a dysochoria and bilateral mitriasis, non-responsive to pupil with absent oculocephalic reflex. And that's kind of a very poor prognostic indicator. So again, pupillary light reflex and pupil size is very, very useful. And then it's intuitive. You've got level of consciousness. A patient that is quite responsive is that doesn't suffer from a severe brain injury. But then you can get to the point where you have semi-comatose patients that only respond to visual stimuli, auditory stimuli, or noxious stimuli, or are comatose. So, for example, if you remember the first cat that we saw that was completely semi-comatose and was only respond not and sorry was actually comatose, not even responsive to noxious stimuli. Well, that's a grade one. But we also have so this one here. But then we can have other semi-comatose patients like this patient here that basically, oops, sorry, just one second, I'll stop it. So this patient, let's see if I can see it from the beginning. Okay, here it is. So this patient is actually semi-comatose, not responding to visual stimuli, but will respond to auditory stimuli. So that's the part of the auditory stimuli, obviously, is not there, but it did respond. And so why is that so important? Because again, the tier approach, so the way that we implement the treatment is based on the modified Glasgow Coma Scale monitoring and assessment. Great. So what if we get a polytrauma? So this cat hit by a car, it's got signs of head trauma. You can see here you've got proptosis. The patient is actually stuporous, it's not responding to any stimulus other than noxious stimuli. The heart rate is quite low, isn't it? Like 110 beats per minute, and the blood pressure is relatively normal, 150. So this is definitely a patient with shock, with probably polytrauma. It's got severe head injury. It's bradycardic if you want, and in cats, you know, bradycardia can be associated with shock, but also we're worried here about the head trauma, increased intracranial pressure. And I would also be worried about this extension of the forelimbs. So actually on the motor activity, I'm quite worried that this patient is abnormal. The blood pressure should be, if it was increased intracranial pressure and a Cushing's reflex, this Doppler pressure would be around 200, 220. So why is it actually 150 in bradycardic? Well, probably in this case, there is a component of hypovolemia, but also a component of traumatic brain injury and increased intracranial pressure that is leading this patient to be bradycardic, but also to be relatively normotensive. I don't know if it makes sense. So in this case, what would you use? Hypertonic saline, or would you use hypertonic saline plus colloids, or mannitol, or would you just go with high isotonic fluids? I suppose what we decided here is we've got a concern. We've said that hypertonic saline is a great resuscitative fluid, initial at least, and it's also a very good hyperosmolar therapy for reducing cerebral brain injury, and I'll talk to you about that. But for example, we could have given isotonic crystalloid, so sodium chloride or potentially Hartmann solution. But here we're worried also about the traumatic brain injury. It's not just shock. And so in this case, what we would do is hypertonic saline, which really catches two birds with a stone, because you've got a patient probably in shock, a patient with traumatic brain injury. Let's give hypertonic saline, which will work on reducing the cerebral edema and work on resuscitating the patient. Why not mannitol? Because mannitol is not a great treatment for shock. And I suppose what we have here is potentially a patient even with mild shock. So you want to make sure that you are covering the cardiovascular side. I hope it makes sense. And here it comes with the hyperosmolar therapy. So basically, when we want to act on cerebral edema or anything that can be associated with traumatic brain injury and potentially intracranial pressure, the point is stabilize them first and then think about reducing the intracranial pressure. How do we do that? Well, by using hyperosmolar therapy that can draw fluid supposedly out of the brain. And so that's why we use either mannitol, which is an osmotic diuretic, or hypertonic saline. And they drop basically, one of the effects is that basically they reduce the water content within the brain parenchyma. But they don't just do that. So, for example, by reducing the hematocrit, because you give these fluids and then basically you draw water in, you decrease the viscosity. If you increase the viscosity, basically you're increasing the oxygen delivery in the brain, because it's more likely that this blood will get to the microcirculation of the brain. And so we're going to increase the cerebral perfusion, for example. And also, what we're going to have is a little bit of free radical scavenging, for example, in the case of mannitol. Mannitol can scavenge the free radicals that accumulate within the brain that has been hypoxic and hence has had these free radicals accumulating, and mannitol can actually scavenge them, considering that they could potentially be deleterious for ongoing secondary brain injury. And so the mannitol is great because it gives you again an osmotic effect. It can increase the vas decrease the viscosity of the blood, and so increase the perfusion and be a free radical scavenging. Unfortunately, it's not great with resuscitation. On the other side, we've got the hypertonic saline, and that's great for, as we said, resuscitation, so expansion of intravascular volume. Even temporary, it's actually quite good. And on top of that, it exerts a hyperosmolar effect, so reducing the extracellular fluid at the level of the brain, and so decreasing the increased intracranial pressure. And then it also has an immunomodulatory effect. So the saline seems to reduce the neutrophil adhesion to the vascular, to the vessel microcirculation, and so reduce the inflammatory response, which is associated with secondary injury. So there are other minor effects, which may not actually be that minor, but are currently unknown in terms of entity of effect. And so we've got these two drugs, which are the better to decrease the intracranial pressure. Well, actually, we don't know, and it really, I think, on my that there's really not much. We don't even know if it is actually that useful in cats, for example. There are not huge evidence. This is a little bit of the paradox of veterinary medicine. There's not huge evidence that supports the use of mannitol or hypertonic saline, for example. But it seems like one of those drugs that we do need to use. Which one's best? Well, I think it really depends on the context. So if you have a stable patient and you're worried about increasing intracranial pressure, you can use either mannitol or hypertonic. But if you have a patient in shock, I think you only have to use hypertonic saline, because that you have to cure the shock as well. And we've seen how much hypoperfusion of the brain can actually lead to exacerbation of cerebral edema. So on one side, you know, if you've got a patient with cerebral edema and you're giving mannitol, that's great, you're reducing that cerebral edema. But on the other side, if there is hypotension or hypoperfusion and you're not curing that hypoperfusion will lead to further increase on cerebral edema within the brain. So patient with shock and traumatic brain injury, I would say use hypertonic saline for now. And so that's what we've done, and you can see the huge improvement just in posture. I don't have a video of this patient, unfortunately, but like you can see how much literally after 10 minutes of hypertonic saline the patient has improved. And probably a little bit is because the patient is no longer in shock, so we've resuscitated the patient, and a little bit also because probably the increased intracranial pressure has reduced with the administration of hypertonic. Great. One thing of the mannitol is that you know, there's a lot of I suppose practice in terms of or of things that we are used to do that we shouldn't be doing. So, for example, giving mannitol shouldn't just preemptively shouldn't be done. You have to make that decision based on Multiple Gloss Glaucoma Scale and overall assessment of your patient. If you're worried about increased intracranial pressure, giving mannitol just to prevent, that's not a great thing, because mannitol can actually induce diuresis, hypovolemia potentially. It's got some other, it's a drug, and so it's got other effects. And you usually we give around 0.25 to 1 gram per kilo. The highest you give, usually a 0.5 grams per kilo is enough. The highest dose you give, the more persistent is the effect. The effect is usually between 1.5 and 6 hours. What we shouldn't do again is maybe plan it every 8 hours to give mannitol, because again, the administration of mannitol needs to be done based on a clinical assessment, not just on the idea that it will reduce the increase in intracranial pressure. And so we'll give it regularly to avoid this increasing this intracranial pressure to increase. So it needs to be given only when you're worried about TBI and increased intracranial pressure. Furosemide, on the textbooks you'll find, on some textbooks, old textbooks, you'll find that furosemide should be given with mannitol, but that's actually no longer recommended in veterinary medicine and in people. Right, so here we go. We've seen a tear approach, and we've kind of explained the first steps. So a patient comes in, seizuring, we treat the seizures, but then we focus on the fluids, oxygen therapy, and ventilation. So or we concentrate, sorry, on the ABC. Then, if the patient has evidence of traumatic brain injury and modified Glasgow Coma Scale is less than 8, so you're worried that there is a traumatic brain injury, well, you can upgrade the patient to whole motor therapy plan, and that can be either with mannitol or hypertonic. Now, if you're worried the patient is unstable and it's got TBI, you can even start hyperosmolar therapy here at level 1 with hypertonic saline. If the patient, the problem is, and most of this patient can actually be treated in your practice, and they can be hugely rewarding, really. Like you can see, dogs and cats have an amazing capacity of rehabilitating themselves, and it's really like their care is really essential, but needs to be optimal in the first 24, 48 hours, because that's essential to determine if the secondary injury is going to determine further damage. But the problem is, when are we worried about, when do we worry about actually implementing our treatment, so with decompression, hyperventilation, or this kind of things, and going on to a level 3. If a patient is not improving after fluids or osmolar therapy, then we have to consider further things. And so we usually think about diagnostics. Now, the most available diagnostic in practice is radiographs. They help detecting fractures, but they don't necessarily help detecting if something is surgical or not. Patients may have fractures, but not necessarily need to have them repaired. And so what we really need is probably a CT scan and MRI. So I think if you're looking for assessing if a patient is not getting any better and you want to see if there's a fracture that you need to repair surgically regarding the skull, probably the CT scan or the MRI would probably be better. If you're looking for spinal fractures, definitely I would probably go with that, with radiographs initially, because it's something that you really want to know before start moving the patient and causing potentially a luxation or worsening the fracture itself. But yes, in some cases we may need CT scan and MRI to be done. And again, it's difficult to, usually medical management is enough, but in cases that don't actually respond to medical management, we may have to escalate and consider surgical treatment. And surgical treatment, like it's just to assess if there's a big mass that we need to remove. So for example, in people, subdural hematoma is something that they would address surgically in some cases. If there are depressed fragments that we need to remove, or even prognostically, has there been herniation of the cerebrum? Like, do we need to what is the likelihood of recovery of this patient? And so, again, thanks to Joe for all these cool images of surgery. But basically, we can consider craniectomy. If the patient is not improving or is very, like, it's got a very low modified Glasgow Coma Scale following MRI or CT scan, and so finding, for example, a depressed bone fragment, for example, that is pressing on the brain, or to see the extent of the hemorrhage, for example, in this case. And this was a surgery where basically a bone fragment was removed. I've spoken about subdural hematomas, and obviously some of our cases can have bleedings. Now, one of the hot topics in trauma is tranexamic acid. Tranexamic acid is basically a drug against fibrinolysis, and some of our patients can be hyperfibrinolytic, meaning that they form a clot, but then that clot is destroyed, and so there is ongoing bleeding. And so that has been looked quite thoroughly in people with large multicenter studies, and it seems like to avoid life-threatening bleeds, tranexamic acid, if given within 3 hours from trauma, can reduce the mortality and the risk of bleeding. It's that powerful. Obviously, this is a very, very big like amount of people enrolled in the study. This could be sometimes useful in our patients. The problem is that in our patients, we don't know if they're hyperfibrinolytic. But for example, if we have a patient with a hematoma that is growing and potentially we don't know how to stop it and we haven't got surgery, we could start considering tranexamic acid. Now, this is all up in the air, and one reason that I don't think we can actually support its use, but it may have to be considered when we have, for example, a suspected hemorrhage that is ongoing, although the evidence is really zero. So the whole point of mentioning is just to raise this point, and I think to raise the question, tranexamic acid, yes or no, but it will have to be answered in the next few years. But it's just something, you know, to think if you've got like a bad hemorrhage and you've kind of ruled out primary or secondary causes of bleedings, well, then you can think about tranexamic acid. Although, again, the window that seems to be useful in people is 3 hours, which is really, really short. So I think at the moment there's not a huge amount of space for this in veterinary practice. Other important things. So we've seen the three-tier approach. The other one was hypothermia. I don't know if you remember. Like, I'll go back just 1 second on that. Here it is. So the third tier was decompression, potentially hyperventilation, which the point beyond that is basically reducing the CO2 and so causing vasoconstriction, as we've seen in the first slides. Vasoconstriction, so reducing the cerebral. The intracranial pressure. However, this is temporary and it's something that can, may be done in acute phase, the first 30 minutes, 1 hour, but it's rarely performed, really. And there's also this hypothermia. So hyperventilation and hypothermia, we don't really do that in veterinary medicine as a common thing, and surely not in practice. But what's this hypothermia? The whole point of hypothermia is we've got a patient that has traumatic brain injury. So it's got cerebral edema. It's at risk of increased intracranial pressure. And what we know is that there's reduced oxygen flow and delivery to the brain. So the brain is actually hypoperfused and has an energy imbalance. So what do we want to do? Probably rather than exciting it, we want actually to reduce its metabolism. So if it's got an energy impairment, we probably want to decrease that cerebral metabolism. And so how do we do that? Well, some people have spoken about hypothermia. That's not necessarily something that is recommended. It was initially like recommended in people, so inducing coma and cooling down to 33%, but it's no longer recommended in people, and it's not recommended in cats either and dogs. Another way would be with sedation or analgesia. What's the point? Well, a stress patient will have an increased oxygen consumption and so basically an energy imbalance. And so we want to reduce the oxygen consumption, and that can also reduce the cerebral edema if that is exacerbated by an energy imbalance, and basically we'll have a reduction in intracranial pressure. Obviously, this sedation and analgesia can actually have cardiovascular and respiratory effects, and so we really need to make sure that the patients are stable or that we're not giving anything that can compromise. So, for example, in an acute setting, I wouldn't probably give alpha 2 agonists because they can compromise so much the cardiac output. And I would go with something a bit more mild but effective in terms of analgesia, for example, like opioids. And obviously, we always have to consider that if we give some sedative or analgesic drugs, well, they will interfere with our neurological examination and assessment. And so, what do we tend to do? I think I would always start with opioids. Always assume that they're painful. And the best ones are probably pure agonists, if you can, in dogs at least. Methadone and fentanyl are very good. Fentanyl is even better because you can titrate that to effect rather than giving boluses and keeping the concentration stable. Buprenorphine is another potential option in cats. It achieves a good analgesia. I would still go with methadone in cats just because we can always top it up, and there's no ceiling effect like buprenorphine has, and so we can always increase it if we want. And then if they're stressed, you could start thinking about midazolam. The problem of midazolam, this is not an analgesic, it would be a sedative, and I think can cause quite a lot of dysphoria. So it's I think we should use it with in selected patients. And then we've got ketamine. Ketamine is a very good analgesic. The problem is, and it seems that it's useful in like refractory status epilepticus that is not responding to the standard ones, to standard treatment. However, I think there's still controversy whether it should be used in patients with increased intracranial pressure because it can increase the cerebral metabolism and increase the intracranial pressure. So I think at the moment, in the acute setting, we shouldn't probably be thinking about ketamine, but may consider that in the following days for sure as an additional analgesic. Speaking of seizures, if the incidence of seizures in patients that present with traumatic brain injury are actually quite low. They're reported zero in cats, although we know that they happen, and 5 to 10% in dogs. And so, because of this theory that you don't want to increase the cerebral metabolism, what you don't want to do is make the patient seizure, well, not make the patient, but allow the patient to seizure again and again. And so we. If a seizure occurs, as we said before, should be given short-term or short-acting drugs, so diazepam and midazolam, and then add on potentially something that has a more long-acting effect, such as phenobarbital or levetiracetam. And they're quite important because, again, what you want to do is that they seizure again. I wouldn't give them preemptively. There's no association between presentation and seizure activity, so there's nothing to predict if a patient will seizure or not. So be very careful. If patients have seizure, probably consider, according to their severity, if to start also long-acting drugs. And remember that if you start long-acting drugs, it's preferable not to stop them straight away. And so probably they may have to be weaned a little bit over time, a little bit gradually, to avoid that they basically go into, again, they develop seizures again. But this is a huge field of research and interest that hasn't been really answered in terms of how do we manage this seizure patients in practice, because the incidence is so low, really. Steroids. I think for now we can say no. And that's it. It's one of those things that were getting in shock because they thought that it would decrease the inflammation. At the moment, there is no evidence to support that we should be giving steroids to these patients in acute phase at all. So it's something that we shouldn't be considering at all. Other things are ancillary treatments. So these patients in the acute phase, we've seen that we have to be on the patient straight on and actually support them. But these are patients that will require, and so we have to be optimal in our treatment in the first 24, 48 hours. But we also have to make sure that basically over the course of the days, this will be patients that, according to the severity, will be hospitalized for at least 1, 2 weeks. Again, it depends on the severity. But and so nutrition is going to be a big, big effect. What we want to avoid is placing nasal gas. So we usually can wait a little bit. Trauma is a very hypercatabolic state, but we don't want to start nutrition straight away. There are other priorities. After 3 days, we start worrying about it. And what we don't want, probably want to do, or what we can do, is probably placing nasogastric or nasopharyngeal tubes in these patients because if they sneeze, that's going to cause increased intracranial pressure. Now, 72 hours is probably going to be a safe window to do that, but it always depends. Do they have nasal fractures? Do we want to put that, like a tube through a patient that has a nasal fracture? And so, if we are anesthetizing, so for example, a lot of cats that present with head trauma will probably have symphyseal fracture of the mandible. And so, in these cases, if we anesthetize to wire the mandible or for some sort of imaging, we can actually place an O-tube, and that would be ideal because it will allow the client to be able to support the patient at home through an O-tube, but also for the patient not to have anything in the face. And so it's quite a good way of treating the patient. And so this is a big aspect, but also other cares. These are patients that may not be able to recover, and sorry, that are not be, able to turn or to be independent. So we have to change recumbency, do oral care. Eye care is another important thing. Like many of these patients may develop corneal ulcer, and you probably don't want to make the patient go through the traumatic brain injury and then have to deal with an eye ulcer. You don't want to give them any problems, so be very careful with eye care and frequent lube every 4 6 hours, for example, similar to oral care, and change recumbency, and then potentially trying to, once they're nice and stable, try to start with some physiotherapy, even if it's just passive range of movements and standing exercise, but anything that can trigger that. Last thing is the prognosis. Prognosis is quite good, but the mortality is still reported around 25% of patients with traumatic brain injury die. And so I think we really need to be careful and on these patients. But I usually find, and this is just my, like, well, in terms of modified Glasgow Coma Scale, that allows us to give a prognostic factor, at least for cats, for dogs. It's not being assessed for cats. And so I would always be very careful in terms of giving a poor prognosis to the patient, to the clients, based just on the modified Glasgow Coma Scale in an acute setting, based on a quick assessment, because they can actually make it quite remarkably, even if they present comatose. So, if, for example, we see our little cat here on admission. This was a few hours after admission, so he wasn't on shock. What we treated him was stabilized, but despite that, there wasn't an improvement in modified Glasgow Coma Scale, and he's still kind of comatose, really. And so you would say this prognosis is terrible. Like, is he actually going to improve? And the conversation with the clients will probably be very pessimistic, I suppose, if you see a case like this. But the reason I would be reluctant is that this is a perfect example of how remarkable and how amazing our pets are. So this was only 3 days later. I mean, it's not running around. I appreciate that, but surely he's a bit more responsive and can be supported. And then if we see at 3 weeks later, so not even, we're not speaking about a year later. Sorry, there's a little bit of problem here. Let's try again. Going. So he's relatively good, and the client reported that he was having a good quality of life, and this is just 3 weeks after the trauma. So it's definitely, I would say, always give them a chance. Obviously, they are financially, this especially the fear cases are financially quite hard to treat, and also emotionally. So the clients need to pro needs improvement, needs to be prompt for what they're going for, but certainly even the ones that look bad can actually make a remarkable recovery. Right, so I hope, I think this is the end. I hope in this hour I kind of explained what I wanted to, and send through the message of having to stabilize the patients, and why using modified Glasgow Coma Scale more to guide the therapy rather than to give prognosis, and do that repeatedly so that basically you can guide it. Choosing the correct hyperosmolar therapy and knowing that we can't do much, but the few things that we can do, we need to get them right again. And also, I think another important thing is, when do we need to start thinking about referral? Most, as I said, most of this can be hugely rewarding in private practice, and in general practice, really. Like when I was in practice, I treated lots of them, and so it is possible to treat them, as you will know. But I think the important thing is recognizing when you have to start thinking, maybe we should escalate diagnostics. We should look for CT scan and MRI in case we need to go for surgery. That's it, really. Thanks for waiting. I'm sorry I went a little bit 15 minutes early, later. Is there any question, by any chance? Doesn't seem like. Great. Well, that's it then. Thanks for listening to the lecture. If you've got any questions, you've got my emails, cortellini@rbc.ac.uk. And thank you very much for attending this. Bye.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Stefano for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.